Chapter 13. Closely identified, for instance, with its legal affairs, that he was almost a part of its university existence, that of course, at a college banquet, he would inevitably speak for the bar. It was wonderful of how much consequence all this had seemed till now. .. 2. When, punctually at 7:10, her husband had emerged from the house, Margaret Ransom remained seated in her bedroom, addressing herself anew to the difficult process of self-collection. As an aid to this endeavor, she bent forward and looked out of the window, following Ransom's figure as it receded down the elm-shaded street. He moved almost alone between the prim flowerless grass plots, the white porches, the protrusion of irrelevant shingle gables, which stamped the empty street as part of an American college town. As he had always been proud of living in Hill Street, where the university people congregated, proud to associate her husband's retreating back, as he walked daily to his office, with backs literary and pedagogic, backs of which it was whispered, for the edification of duly impressed visitors, wait till that old boy turns that so-and-so. This had been her world, a world destitute of personal experience, but filled with a rich sense of privilege and distinction, of being not as those millions were who, denied the inestimable advantage of living at Wentworth, pursued elsewhere careers foredoomed to futility by that very fact. And now, she rose and turned to her work table, where as he had dropped, on entering, the handful of photographs that Guy Donish had left with her. While he sat so close, pointing out and explaining, as he had hardly taken in the details, but now, on the full tones of his low young voice, they came back with redoubled distinctness. This was Guy's Abbey, his uncle's place in Wiltshire, where, under his grandfather's rule, Guy's own boyhood had been spent. A long gabled Jacobine facade, many-chimneyed, ivy-draped, overhung, she felt sure, by the boughs of a venerable rookery. And in this other picture the walled garden at Guy's, that was his uncle, Lord Askern, a hale gouty-looking figure, planted robustly on the terrace, a gun on his shoulder and a couple of setters at his feet. And here was the river below the park, with Guy unting a girl in a flapping hat, how Margaret hated the flap that hit the girl's face. And here was the tennis court, with Guy among a jolly cross-legged group of youths in flannels, and pretty girls about the tea table under the big lime. In the center the curate handing bread and butter, and in the middle distance a footman approaching with more cups. Margaret raised this picture closer to her eyes, puzzling, in the diminished light, over the face of the girl nearest to Guy Donish bent above him in profile, while he laughingly lifted his head. No hat hit this profile, which stood out clearly against the foliage behind it. "And who is that handsome girl?" Margaret had said, detaining the photograph as he pushed it aside, and struck by the fact that, of the whole group, he had left only this member unnamed. "Oh, only Gwendolyn Matcher, I've always known her. Look at this. The almshouses at Guy's. Aren't they jolly?" And then without her having had the courage to ask if the girl in the punt were also Gwendolyn Matcher, they passed on to photographs of his rooms at Oxford, of a cousin's studio in London. One of Lord Askern's grandsons was artistic of the rose-hung cottage in Wales, to which, on the old earl's death, his daughter-in-law, Guy's mother, had retired. Every one of the photographs opened a window on the life Margaret had been trying to picture since as he had known him, a life so rich, so romantic, so packed in the mere casual vocabulary of daily life with historic reference and poetic allusion, that she felt almost oppressed by this distant whiff of its air. The very words he used fascinated and bewildered her. He seemed to have been born into all sorts of connections, political, historical, official, that made the Ransom situation at Wentworth as featureless as the top shelf of a dark closet. Someone in the family had asked for the children hundreds. One uncle was an elder brother of the Trinity House. Someone else was the master of a college. Someone was in command at Devonport. The Army, the Navy, the House of Commons, the House of Lords, the most venerable seats of learning, were all woven into the dense background of this young man's light unconscious talk. For the unconsciousness was unmistakable. Margaret was not without experience of the transatlantic visitor who sounds loud names and evokes reverberating connections. The poetry of Guy Donish's situation lay in the fact that it was so completely a part of early associations and accepted facts. Life was like that in England in Wentworth, of course, where he had been sent, through his uncle's influence, for 2 years training in the neighboring electrical works at Smeddon, in Wentworth. Though immensely jolly, it was different. The fact that he was qualifying to be an electrical engineer with the hope of a secretaryship at the London end of the great Smeddon Company that, at best, he was returning home to a life of industrial grind, this fact, though avowedly a bore, did not disconnect him from that brilliant pinnacled past, that many-faceted life in which the brightest episodes of the whole body of English fiction seemed collectively reflected. Of course he would have to work, younger sons almost always had to, but his uncle Askern, like Wentworth, was immensely jolly, and Guy's always open to him, and his other uncle, the master, a capital old boy too, and in town he could always put up with his clever aunt, Lady Caroline Duckett, who had made a Eastleigh marriage, and was horribly poor, but who knew everybody jolly and amusing, and had always been particularly kind to him. It was not, and Margaret had not, even in her own thoughts, to defend herself from the imputation, it was not what Wentworth would have called the ethereal side of her friend's situation that captivated her. She was austerely proof against such appeals. Her enthusiasms were all of the imaginative order. What subjugated her was the unexampled prodigality with which he poured for her the same draft of tradition, of which Wentworth held out its little teacupful. He beseeched her with a million Wentworths in one, saying, as it were, colon, all these are mine for the asking, and I choose you instead. For this, she told herself somewhat dizzily, was what it came to the summing up toward which her conscientious efforts at self-collection had been gradually pushing her. With all this in reach, Guy Donish was leaving Wentworth reluctantly. I was a bit lonely here at first, but now. And again, colon, it will be jolly, of course, to see them all again, but there are some things one doesn't easily give up. If he had known only Wentworth, it would have been wonderful enough that he should have chosen her out of all Wentworth, but to have known that other life, and to set her in the balance against it, poor Margaret Ransom, in whom, at the moment, nothing seemed of weight but her years. Ah, it might well produce, in nerves and brain, and poor unpracticed pulses, a flushed tumult of sensation, the rush of a great wave of life, under which memory struggled in vain to reassert itself, to particularize again just what his last words the very last had been. When consciousness emerged, quivering, from this retrospective assault, it pushed Margaret Ransom, feeling herself a mere leaf in the blast, toward the writing table from which her innocent and voluminous correspondence habitually flowed. As he had a letter, to write now much shorter, but more difficult than any as he had ever been called on to indite. Dear Mr. Donish, she began, since telephoning you just now I have decided not, Maria's voice, at the door, announced that he was in the library. And I suppose it's the brown silk you'll wear to the speaking? In the usual order of the Ransom existence, its mistress's toilet was performed unassisted, and the mere enquiry at once friendly and deferential projected, for Margaret, a strong light on the importance of the occasion. That she should answer colon, but I am not going, when the going was so manifestly part of a household solemnity about which the thoughts below stairs fluttered in proud participation, that in face of such participation she should utter a word implying indifference or hesitation, nay, revealing herself the transposed, uprooted thing as he had been on the verge of becoming. To do this was well. infinitely harder than to perform the alternative act of tearing up the sheet of notepaper under her reluctant pen. Yes, she said, she would wear the brown silk. Three. All the heat and glare from the long illuminated table, about which the fumes of many courses still hung in a savory fog, seemed to surge up to the ladies' gallery and concentrate themselves in the burning cheeks of a slender figure withdrawn behind the projection of a pillar. It never occurred to Margaret Ransom that she was sitting in the shade. She supposed that the full light of the chandeliers was beating on her face, and there were moments when it seemed as though all the heads about the great horseshoe below, bald, shaggy, sleek, close-thatched, or thinly latticed, were equipped with an additional pair of eyes, set at an angle which enabled them to rake her face as relentlessly as the electric burners. In the lull after a speech, the gallery was fluttering with the rustle of programs consulted, and Mrs. Sheff, the Brandt girl's aunt, leaned forward to say enthusiastically, "Colin, and now we're to hear Mr. Ransom." A louder buzz rose from the table, and the heads, without relaxing their upward vigilance, seemed to merge and flow together, like an attentive flood, toward the upper end of the horseshoe, where all the threads of Margaret Ransom's consciousness were suddenly drawn into what seemed a small speck, no more a black speck that rose, hung in air, dissolved in two gyrating gestures, became distended, enormous, preponderant, became her husband, peaking. "It's the heat," Margaret gasped, pressing her handkerchief to her whitening lips, and finding just strength enough left to push back farther into the shadow. She felt a touch on her arm. "It is horrible, shall we go?" a voice suggested. And, "Yes, yes, let us go," she whispered, feeling, with a great throb of relief, that to be the only possible, the only conceivable, solution. To sit and listen to her husband now, how could she ever have thought she could survive it? Luckily, under the lingering hubbub from below, his opening words were inaudible, and as he had only to run the gauntlet of sympathetic feminine glances, shot after her between waving fans and programs, as, guided by Guy Dawnish, she managed to reach the door. It was really so hot that even Mrs. Sheff was not much surprised till long afterward. The winding staircase was empty, half dark and blessedly silent. In the committee room below, Dawnish found the inevitable water jug and filled a glass for her, while she leaned back, confronted only by a frowning college president in an emblazoned frame. The academic frown descended on her like an anathema when she rose and followed her companion out of the building. Hamblin Hall stands at the end of the long green campus with its sextuple line of elms, the boast and the singularity of Wentworth. A pale spring moon, rising above the dome of the university library at the opposite end of the elm walk, diffused a pearly mildness in the sky, melted to thin haze the shadows of the trees, and turned to golden yellow the lights of the college windows. Against this soft suffusion of light, the library cupola assumed a Brahmin-esque grace. The white steeple of the Congregational Church became a campanile topped by a winged spirit, and the scant porticos of the older halls the colonnades of classic temples. "This is better," Dawnish said, as they passed down the steps and under the shadow of the elms. They moved on a little way in silence before he began again, "Colin, you're too tired to walk. Let us sit down a few minutes." Her feet, in truth, were leaden, and not far off a group of park benches, encircling the pedestal of a patriot in bronze, invited them to rest. But Dawnish was guiding her toward a lateral path which bent, through shrubberies, toward a strip of turf between two of the buildings. "It will be cooler by the river," he said, moving on without waiting for a possible protest. None came. It seemed easier, for the moment, to let herself be led without any conventional feint of resistance. And besides, there was nothing wrong about this. The wrong would have been in sitting up there in the glare, pretending to listen to her husband, a dutiful wife among her kind. The path descended, as both knew, to the chosen, the inimitable spot of Wentworth. that fugitive curve of the river, where, before hurrying on to glut the brutal industries of South Wentworth and Smedon, it simulated for a few hundred yards the leisurely pace of an ancient university stream, with willows on its banks and a stretch of turf extending from the grounds of Hamblin Hall to the boathouses at the farther bend. Here too were benches, beneath the willows, and so close to the river, that the voice of its gliding softened and filled out the reverberating silence between Margaret and her companion, and made her feel that she knew why he had brought her there. "Do you feel better?" he asked gently as he sat down beside her. "Oh, yes. I only needed a little air. I'm so glad you did. Of course the speeches were tremendously interesting, but I prefer this. What a good night." "Yes." There was a pause, which now, after all, the soothing accompaniment of the river seemed hardly sufficient to fill. "I wonder what time it is. I ought to be going home," Margaret began at length. "Oh, it's not late. They'll be at it for hours in there yet." She made a faint inarticulate sound. She wanted to say, "No," Robert's speech was to be the last, but she could not bring herself to pronounce Ransom's name, and at the moment, no other way of refuting her companion's statement occurred to her. The young man leaned back luxuriously, reassured by her silence. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.